Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Times are changing. Smartphones and tablets are becoming the equivalent of pencil and paper in many schools, whether it be flashcards, agendas, or textbooks. Nowadays, almost anything that was once used for class is now available in digital form on the iPhone or Android. With so many different learning apps out there, it's often tough to know which ones are the best for you or your child. Joining us now by phone is Time Magazine's tech writer, John Patrick Pullen. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks for having me, Ann. It's great to be here.
You recently wrote about some top back-to-school apps. Let's talk about, well, first of all, what made the cut in general? What were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for a wide range of apps. You know, kids these days as young as 11 are getting smartphones, and maybe even younger than that. So these are in the hands of all sorts of students, and we wanted to make sure that we reached the wide breadth of people who are wanting to learn, and that includes adults as well.
Let's talk first about Brainscape. What is it?
Hello?
Brainscape, yep.
Oh, yeah. Well, Brainscape is a great app. It's free on Apple's iOS. It's not available on Android. And it's a flashcard app. What it does is tailors the timing to the student's individual learning needs, which is something you can't really do with paper.
What sort of subjects does it work with well? I mean, is it just like, you know, what we think of as the multiplication tables or language, foreign language? What sort of subjects?
Well, really anything that you want it to be, because you can make your own. So that helps it, you know, even in the workplace. But everything from world geography to foreign language vocabulary, you name it. And you, like I said, you can make your own flashcards, but you can also purchase pre-made sets. So it kind of makes it a little bit easier.
So it's free if you want to make your own, and then an additional cost for the pre-made.
Oh, yeah, there's always an upsell, especially with education apps.
There's always an upsell. How does a flashcard app work on in digital form?
Much like you'd expect. I mean, they're pretty intuitive. You just swipe or tap, and it reveals the other side. But that also brings up an interesting point to these apps in general, especially learning apps. A flashcard app really lacks the touch and feel of paper. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, you know, you come to learn in your journey through education is how you learn individually. For me, I hated taking notes. I absolutely hated putting pen to paper, which is funny considering my job now.
Mm-hmm.
but what I discovered was that when I did that, I actually retained the knowledge more easily. So While these are great apps, and especially Brainscape's an excellent app for people looking to learn, it may not be for everybody.
You know, I loved, just for the record, I loved taking notes. I was one of those. But when I took a foreign language in college, I made my own flashcards because I knew what words I had to learn for the next vocabulary quiz, right? And there was something about that stack of cards. It gave me a sense about what I needed to know. I often wonder when you condense it all into a digital form, the volume, you lose sense and an association with the volume.
Absolutely. And I think developers work on that because they do understand these real-world trade-offs, but there's nothing that compares to paper. You know, we're talking about how great these phones are and apps are, but that's the truth. Sometimes you need to write things out. And you need to be able to sort and pull out those two or three flashcards that are still bothering you, those two or three vocab words.
So speaking of vocabulary and language, there's another app that you wrote about. It's called Duolingo. What is it?
Duolingo is free on both Android, iOS, and actually it's on Windows Phone as well. I neglected to include that. I'll have to go back and add it to the story, but it basically gamifies language learning. Now, gamifies is one of those terms,
mm-hmm.
but it does a really great job at making learning fun,
even when it comes to a foreign language.
Yeah, especially, you know, I mean, you're learning really interesting things, not just vocabulary, not just ways to speak to each other, but etymology. Our language comes, you know, from so many other languages, mostly Romance, but to be able to take that in, it can be fun. I learned more about writing English than when I took German.
So what languages are taught in the app? Do you get, is it free or how does it work?
Sure, it is free. And they do everything. I mean, from Portuguese, Swedish, Dutch, German, French, anything under the sun, they're going to try to teach you to learn it. Now, they again, there's upsells and there's vocab packs and things like that. But to get in on this, you know, especially even in the summertime to brush up before you get back to school, it's a good way to use your phone.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about back-to-school apps with John Patrick Pullen. He's a tech writer for Time Magazine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. You write that the app functions, the Duolingo app we've been talking about, it functions similar to both role-playing games and also racing games. And you mentioned the gamification of it. How does that work? For instance, role-playing, how does that come into play? No pun intended.
Sure. Everybody remembers The Legend of Zelda, and you've got, you know, you're traveling around with this character named Link and fighting, and you have hearts. And every time you get hit, you kind of lose half a heart on your life meter, and this works similarly. If you get something wrong, you lose half a heart, or you know, or maybe a full heart, depending on how bad you failed on it. And so that makes it similar to a role playing game. For racing games, they have aspects that are like streaks. So you want to stay on track, and you want to, you know, keep building upon your previous success. And that'll help you build your confidence as well. So similarly, it's like a racer. But fundamentally, it comes back to learning. And like I said, building on that confidence and having that facility with the languages. And, you know, everyone needs to eat their broccoli. But elements like these make it taste better, like when you put cheese on top.
You know, going back to that conversation we were having about, you know, the need for paper and writing things down and how that, for some people, is a great way to learn. Do you think the generations coming up that have been weaned on smartphones and iPads and so forth are necessarily going to have that same relationship?
It goes back to really how you learn originally, in my view. Mm-hmm. So what we're calling these younger generations are digital natives. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. There have been job postings looking for digital natives, like that's an attractive thing. And people kind of wonder, well, is that discriminatory? but the fact is, they have a facility with computers that a lot of people growing up didn't have that came to them later in life. So it'll be interesting to see this develop. Now, just this morning, I was listening to the radio, and I heard an ad by Bic, and it was all about, you know, how handwriting can help you, not just to pass notes to your friends, or if they do that anymore, you get busted for pulling your cell phone out. but it will help you to learn. So there are campaigns out there to keep pushing ink, and, you know, for what it's worth, it's we grew up with it, and I still use it quite a bit in my work.
You wrote as well about an app called EasyBib. It's a free bibliography generator. Tell us how that works.
This is just a quick inclusion in the list, but gosh, man, I wish I had it. So if you're in the realm of research papers, and almost every college student is, at least to some degree, you've got to source your material, and there are different ways, different citation styles to do that. It's almost like a rite of passage. you have to do these things to move on to, you know, that course that you really wanted to take and get rid of this waste of time, which is punctuation has to be exactly correct. And it's almost like a code. So anyway, EasyBib, what it does, it's a free app for Android and iOS. And you just take your camera, your smartphone's camera, point it at the book's barcode, and it will automatically build the citation for your research paper if you're using that particular volume.
That's just not fair.
I
feel so
I'm not
going to
look. That's true. That's true. But it's almost like, you know, I know I'm really reaching here, but like this is the evolution of tools, and this is we went from rock to hammer to this, and I applaud it.
Oh my gosh, I'm just not going to let my kid know about it. Is all, you know, I mean, that's the equivalent of walking 7 miles through the snow to get to school every morning.
Right, but you know you didn't do that.
Yeah, I didn't do that, but I had to write my own bibliographies, and it almost killed me a few times.
That's true.
And back when they banned onion paper, too, so erasable
paper. Oh, we're reaching now.
Yeah, I know. It's horrible. All right, so iHomework is another app. It seems like mostly just a planner, right? A scheduler, right?
Sure, but it's loaded with tools. It's absolutely loaded. So it's $1.99 on Apple's iOS, not available on any other platform. But what you get with it is just it's like a trapper keeper for the digital age. The big thing is, to me, it has the possibility to really eliminate a lot of anxiety about school. Everyone's got that nightmare that you're in the wrong class with the wrong homework. And that's what this is really designed to eliminate. So, you know, you put your classes in, you know where you're supposed to be at what time. You can put your homework assignments in to, you know what your due dates are. You can even link it to Questia, and it'll kind of link it to your reading material for your assignments. But here's the place that I really like it. You can sort by due date. You can sort that due date by week, day, or month, or you can sort it by course. And so I remember when I was in college, I actually had two different to-do lists. And it was the same thing, just written two different ways. And to be able to change that at the just tap of the screen is that's pretty amazing.
Why did you have two different to-do lists?
Because I thought two different ways. I probably overthought it, you know, but like, when is the, what's next? You know, that's what, you know, okay. As a deadline-driven journalist, mm-hmm. I'm still thinking that way. What's next? And then the other to-do list is listing it by course. Mm. You know, can I bang out this, and this on this course and just get that class completely out of the way and focus on maybe a more difficult one? And even if I'm doing next week's assignments now, I won't have to prioritize that later.
And then here comes the bus. It sounds like the title of a child's book, but it's an app.
It does. Actually, I want to touch on one last thing that iHomework does, because
okay.
This is a great thing that a lot of apps do, but not necessarily in this space. They use Apple's new iCloud syncing. So what it does is, whether you're pulling out your iPhone or your iPad, you're looking at the same stuff. All your data is held up in the cloud. And, you know, also that's great too, especially the way kids beat up phones these days. Mm-hmm. If you happen to drop your phone, you just, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a new one easily, you load it up and it'll pick up where it left off. So you don't have an excuse that the cloud ate your homework.
Okay. So then how to catch the bus, a perennial problem.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the biggest thing, and we'll come back to anxiety on this, is when you're sitting there waiting for the bus, you're in two states. You're wondering, when is the bus coming? And has the bus already come?
Mm-hmm.
So what this does is links to GPS-equipped buses that, you know, several school districts have them. So you'll want to look into see if your school district supports this. This is for grade and high schoolers. But you can basically track your bus and see when it's going to arrive, how soon, how much time you have, if it's going to be late. And this is also, a can't-miss app for parents as well, because we live in an age where we hear a lot of horror stories, but we have the digital tools to feel better if we just deploy them correctly.
All right. Well, John Patrick Poland, thanks for joining us today to talk about them.
Thanks so much, Ann. Pleasure to be here.
John Patrick Poland, he's a tech writer for Time Magazine. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. For decades, Microsoft Windows has had a pretty tight grip on the computer market. Lately, however, Windows sales have dropped. The last edition, Windows 8, was both a critical and financial flop. Windows 10 was designed to alter that trend. Joining us now by phone is the author of the new Windows 10 for Dummies, Andy Rathbone. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've written a lot of books about for dummies about Windows.
Oh, yeah. I wrote the first Windows for Dummies back in 1992, and I've been putting out a new version just about every year since then.
Is it getting easier to write about it for dummies or not?
It's getting a lot harder because, you know, I'm limited to about 400 pages, and Microsoft keeps adding more and more features to Windows. And so it's hard to cover everything.
How is Windows 10? Well, I guess Windows 10 is news because Windows 8 was such a disaster. What were the problems with Windows 8?
Oh, Windows 8 was awful. The problem is that desktop PCs just aren't exciting anymore. You know, they've just turned into tools, and people are now using their smartphones for everything, either a smartphone or a tablet, because it's always with them. So they just reach for that first naturally, and Microsoft's phones never went anywhere. Nobody really liked them, and so Android and Apple took over. And so the desktop PC market it's going down in the market share. So with Windows 8, Microsoft tried to make the desktop PC work more like a smartphone, and they introduced apps that you could run on your desktop PC instead of desktop programs. And they really changed Windows. They got rid of the start menu. They got rid of the start button. They just had this big screen across your monitor filled with little icons for apps. And they were really unprepared for the response. They thought everybody would just eat it up and go out and buy a Windows tablet and life would go on. But everybody hated it. And it was really awkward to use on a desktop computer. And so Microsoft rushed out Windows 8.1 a year later. That didn't quite do it. And so with Windows 10, Microsoft is finally realizing that the desktop PC owners are not going away, so they've got to make the computers more easy to use. And Windows 10 brings back the start button, brings back the start menu, and it's a lot easier to use on a desktop PC.
How do you – is it anything of a hybrid of 8.1, I guess, and 10? I mean, is there much from 8 or 8.1 that is worth talking about?
There's – Windows 10 can still run the apps. In a way, Windows 10's biggest feature is that it can detect what device it's being run on, and then it tailors itself for that device. If you're running on a tablet, it's going to have a larger start menu with the larger app tiles that you can click. When you switch to the desktop on a tablet, it'll space out the menus, so it makes it easier to tap them with your finger. If it's running on a desktop computer, though, the start menu will return to the normal Windows 7 type of start menu, and the start button, which is a lot easier to point and click at with a mouse.
And how do people like all of this? I mean, that's a big deal that you're adapting to the different formats.
It is, yeah. And people are really excited about Windows 10. It's kind of hard to explain why. I think the biggest draw is probably that Windows 10 is free. for the first year after its release, and so people are rushing out to upgrade. In the past, people would never upgrade to a new version of Windows until they got a new computer, and then they, you know, they had to learn the new version. But now people are all excited about upgrading to Windows 10 on their Windows 7, Windows 8, and 8.1 computers.
Well, all right, so Windows 8 and 8.1, not much better, but was a financial disaster for Microsoft. So what are they doing to make money if they're giving away for free for a year?
Well, they want to get everybody using Windows 10 and being able to run apps, because they're only going to get developers to start creating apps if there's a huge market out there.
Mm-hmm.
So by having so many people running Windows 10, being able to run the apps, the developers will finally start creating more apps for the App Store. Because right now, there just aren't as many quality apps written for Windows as they are for the iPad, for instance, or for Android phones.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Andy Rathbone. He's the author of Windows 10 for Dummies. He's been writing the Dummies books about Windows since the beginning. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question there. Let's talk about apps versus programs. What ultimately is the difference between an app and a program?
An app is simpler to use. It performs one function very well, but desktop programs are more powerful and let you do more things. Apps are easier to figure out than desktop programs, and apps work better on touchscreens. That's the big difference.
Cortana, Microsoft's version of Apple's Siri, is now a big part of the Windows operating system. Tell us about Cortana and how it compares.
Well, it's kind of a love it or hate it thing. Some people like the idea of having a personal assistant on their computer that they can just talk to. You know, it's kind of like Star Trek, you know. But it works well when you type your questions into the Cortana search box. And Cortana can usually come up with the answer pretty easily. I'm not a big fan of talking to Cortana. It just seems kind of weird talking to my computer. And a lot of times she just doesn't recognize what I'm saying, and I end up playing word games with her all the time. So I like the idea of Cortana, and I like the way it's integrated in the search box. I just don't like trying to, you know, talking to her and having her try and figure out what I'm saying.
So is it more of a gimmick, or does it actually serve a real purpose? Is it something that they're catering to, that reflects that they're catering to sort of that digital native group, or what?
Well, it serves a great purpose. It does it, as a search tool. It works really well. With the voice interface, some people are going to love that. Some people are going to hate it. Just like with the iPad, I know a lot of people when they'll accidentally hold their button down on the iPad too long, and Siri comes on, and then their biggest question is, "How do I turn this darn thing off?" You know, but Cortana can be turned off pretty easily, and you can just use the search box, type in your command, and it works great. It also works great when it's connected to the browser, the web browser on there. So you can just highlight terms and then punch a button, and Cortana will automatically go to the Internet, grab the information, and put it on the side of your screen, which saves you from typing a lot of stuff into Google or a search engine.
When you're writing a Dummies book, how do you start, and how did writing about Windows 10 differ from others?
Well, Windows 10, Microsoft released a program called the Windows Insider program. You could sign up, and then they would send you pre-release builds of Windows 10. So I started writing the book in February, and when writing a book about it, I pretty much have to write the book for each build, and then I go through when the next build comes out, you know, like a month or a couple weeks later, I have to go through the book and change everything that's changed to bring it up to date with that build. And I've got to do that about 10 times. So in a way, it's like writing the book 10 times, you know. It's very difficult. And then once when Microsoft comes out with the final version of Windows 10, then I go through and make the final changes, send it off to the publisher, and then they put it out in the bookstores.
What are some of your favorite things about this new operating system?
Well, I like Windows 10 on tablets. I like the way that it spaces out the menus automatically. When I switch to the desktop on my tablet, it used to be I'd have a tablet, but I have to carry around a mouse to work on the desktop, and that's you don't have to do that anymore with Windows Windows 10. Windows 10 also works a lot better on a desktop because the start button's back there, the start menu is recognizable, and it makes it easier to find your programs in Windows 8 and Windows 8.1.
There are some people that were irritated by the hot corners in Windows 8. What were those, and they've been removed, I understand.
Yeah, the thing about the hot corners is that if you moved your mouse up into the a certain corner of the screen, then a menu would pop up and you could do certain things, see what programs you have running, for instance. But the problem with Windows 8 and 8.1 is that you didn't know what corner did what. And the only way you would find the menu is if you'd accidentally move your mouse too far in one direction, and then it would just pop up. There was really no help menu included with Windows 8 to introduce people to this new way of using their computers. And that's why everyone hated it. I mean, it was just trial and error. And nobody wants to spend that much time poking around their computer.
I guess, one question is then how did you write about Windows 8? How did you even start that?
It was very hard to write because it was so different, and I couldn't believe that Microsoft would make this big mistake and just dump this thing out in the market and expect people to embrace it. Microsoft was really convinced that everyone was going to go out and buy a tablet, a touchscreen tablet, and use Windows 8. And Windows 8 worked fairly well on a tablet, but on a desktop, it was just awful. It was only until the book was almost written that I realized Microsoft was really going to release that thing. And, I just made the best of it and just tried to put as much helpful information in the book as I could, because people were never going to find this stuff out on their own. There was no tutorial built into Windows 8.
Was good for business for you, though, right?
It was. Windows 8 sold very well because it was so confusing. Windows 8 for dummies. Everyone had to buy a copy just to figure out what is this thing.
So 10, has there been an adequate tutorial included with it?
They've gone out of their way to put a tutorial in there. Yeah, I was pleased to see that. And giving it away for free, they're getting a lot of people are talking about Windows 10. There's a lot of media interest in it, and a lot of people are upgrading their computers. And I can see if people are running Windows 8 or Windows 8.1, they would probably want to upgrade to Windows 10 because it offers a lot of improvement. The big question is whether the Windows 7 people are going to upgrade.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot harder to upgrade and to keep all of your programs and make sure all of your accessories plugged into your computer, make sure they'll still work under Windows 10. So, I recommend that Windows 8 people and Windows 8.1 owners upgrade to Windows 10 because it's a pretty smooth transition. Windows 7, I would recommend that you stay with Windows 7 unless, you're really not happy with Windows 7 for some reason.
Was this, does this just all boil down to a huge miscalculation on the part of Microsoft people about how many people out there would be satisfied with using mostly on their tablets?
Yeah, they saw the iPad taking off, and they thought that, we can do this, and so they released Windows 8 and targeted it directly for the touchscreen tablet market and pretty much threw the desktop owners under the bus. They people didn't like that.
Well, I want to thank you, Andy Rathbone, for joining us today to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Andy Rathbone, he's the author of Windows 10 for Dummies, as well as all the Windows for Dummies books over the years. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. And while you're at it, be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The smartphone market is crammed with competition. Apple has the iPhone, Samsung the S6, and LG has the G4, among others. With the market already saturated, smaller companies have their work cut out for them in finding a niche. OnePlus, a small China-based company, looks to do just that. They released their first smartphone iteration to moderate success. They now are releasing their second, the OnePlus 2. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Hi, Russell.
Hey.
So the OnePlus 2. First off, for those of us who are unfamiliar with the company OnePlus, tell us about them.
They are a small Chinese company that is offset from a larger Chinese company called Oppo. A couple of people from Oppo left that company to kind of start OnePlus with this focus on being kind of grassroots, where they reach out, you know, very minimal marketing, very social media focused, and, you know, they design what they think is the best possible product and release it at as reasonable a price point as they can manage.
So are they just looking for a natural buzz then to get their stuff out there?
Yes, that's essentially what happened with the launch of the OnePlus One. There was a huge, you know, kind of social swell for this company. You know, people who are very, very into smartphones, you know, the latest technology, got really excited about having these kind of high-end specs in a phone at a relatively inexpensive price tag. And it did well for them. It did so well for them that they spent months trying to keep up with the demand. And you know, it took them a whole lot longer to do so.
All right. So you write in your article that the way OnePlus announced their new phone, the OnePlus 2, was unusual. How so?
Well, so their latest announcement happened, this kind of slow trickle of information about the phone over the course of a month and a half, where they talked about the processor and the kind of screen it was going to have and things like that. We usually see that in like an hour-long announcement that a company will do. And then they had the press come and take a look at the phone and then made the announcement through virtual reality headsets. They actually sent a Google Cardboard unit to tons of their fans so that they could watch this unique kind of announcement video through virtual reality headsets all at the same time, all around the world.
And how did that come off?
It was handled really well. I think that most of the people who watched it were really happy about it. There was some interesting information missing that frustrated a couple of people, like the price tag for the phone, which was available as soon as the presentation was over, but wasn't a part of the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that upset a bunch of people. But the idea was relatively unique, and it really continues this kind of you know, very minimal, not particularly expensive push to get, you know, the kind of core audience that they want, which is really these kind of, you know, thoroughly engrossed smartphone users.
You mentioned high-end specs for at a lower price point, and if they're not getting the volume, if they're really interested in a specific kind of customer, how are they making money off of it?
That's been a big part of getting answers to this particular question. We know that the OnePlus One did not make them a ton of money per phone. It was very, very small. It was sold basically at cost. And the OnePlus Two, it's been made very clear that, you know, one of the big problems they have is that they have to buy components a little more expensive than their biggest competitors, and yet they're still selling their phone cheaper than, let's say, the Galaxy S5 or the LG G4. And, you know, in doing so, most of their money is going to be made off of things like accessories.
It's kind of intriguing in a way that there's something focused on something so, I don't know what the word is, stylized in terms of the quality of the product. But so it's not just some junky phone they're pawning off. They're putting a lot of thought into it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the OnePlus One, for it was just, you know, a $300 phone. And for a $300 phone, it was absolutely phenomenal. It didn't compete directly with, say, the iPhone that was released at around the same time. When it came to things like the camera, wasn't nearly as good. But when you look at things like the battery, the speaker quality, the actual, you know, feel when you held the phone in your hand, it was remarkable for $300. And the OnePlus 2 carries very much the same you know, kind of weight behind it. It's a very sturdy feeling phone. The camera is much better this year. It's got some brand new technology to it, including a fingerprint sensor that is noticeably faster than Apple's Touch ID or the fingerprint sensor in the Galaxy S6, and it's $400.
So it's a little more. It's $100 more than last year.
It's $100 more than last year, and it feels like it. This absolutely feels like an upgrade. And at the same time, it keeps very much the same kind of design language. You know, its only real flaws are that it lacks some of the real high end features that we see in Samsung and LG phones, like the ability to rapidly charge the phone when it's plugged into the wall through special chargers that will charge it from 0 to 60% in half an hour, or wireless charging or near field communication. These are all extras that we expect to see in $500 and $600 and $700 phones that are running Android, and those are present in here, but the processor is very much the same processor that you find in the LG G4 and the HTC One M9, and it's got really every other thing on paper that you would expect a high end phone to have.
It's interesting. They just put a lot of thought into what do people really want, what do they really need, what can we make the most of.
That seems to be the overall impression that I've gotten from the company. I spoke to the co-founder of the company during their launch event, and he seems like a really laid back individual who is very much interested in building the best phone that they can, and kind of creating this niche for themselves. In a market where Apple and Samsung and LG and Motorola are the names that you look at when you go to get a phone.
How do you find them? You just can buy them online? Is that the only way?
This is entirely purchased online, and because they have such kind of crazy volume restrictions where they've only got so many to sell, they use this invite system to purchase their phones, which is kind of a bummer. You basically have to have an invite to purchase the phone in order to go to their website and make the purchase. Otherwise, you have to go and request an invite to purchase the phone. So it's nowhere near as easy to buy as you would expect a normal smartphone to be as a result.
It's just also anti, what's the word? counterintuitive, I guess, is, and I am intrigued by that.
It is. It's definitely one of those things that it's not what you would normally expect from a smartphone launch. And I've only had this particular phone for about a day and a half now, but it's been, really enjoyable. I've been very surprised, and really this whole year, the group that I work with, we've been really talking about what $300 and $400 gets you in a smartphone nowadays, and how it may not be worth it to spend the $600 or $700 on the latest Samsung phone or iPhone anymore.
Maybe it's the sign of a future. It feels like a slow burn that they're working on and trying to really suss out what people want and need in a phone. And I'm intrigued. So I imagine we'll continue to follow that. Right, Russell?
Absolutely.
I'm talking with Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You have a question for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wanted to talk about the stage fright Android exploit. It's a security risk for Android phones. What is stage fright exploit?
So stage fright refers to a series of technologies inside of an Android phone that handle media, basically how media playback happens. And there was an exploit found that allowed kind of erroneous information to be attached to a media file, let's say a video file or an audio file, that would cause problems, like the phone would reboot and kind of constantly reboot and things like that. It's not like access to personal information or anything like that, but it's noticeably harmful to the day-to-day use of the phone. And that exploit was found to be linked to the way that media messages are received. So text messages that have video and audio in them, those kind of special media messages, can trip this exploit and then cause these things to happen to your phone. And so if you had a phone where you got a message and the message was automatically downloaded and showed to you as soon as you open the message, it didn't have to do any download or anything, then you would be at risk without ever having actually seen the message. So you could be asleep and someone could send you a funny message, and that message could cause the problem. So you woke up in the morning, or your phone was just constantly rebooting, or you're doing something crazy like that.
Is this something someone did on purpose, or is this a glitch?
This is a mistake that was found and is being corrected. This was something that a security researcher found and went to Google months ago and said, you know, these are these problems that I found, and, you know, this is how I think we go about fixing it. And Google and Samsung and these companies have now, you know, published this information saying, you know, these are security vulnerabilities that we found, and this is how we're fixing it.
Go ahead.
There are updates coming out now that are making it so that this isn't a problem.
How many people have been affected by it?
You know, no one has actually been affected by it. There are no malicious things being sent out to people that will cause your phone to reboot. It was a possibility under these circumstances that could have happened if someone with malicious intent had discovered this bug before the security researcher did, then, you know, a mass messaging campaign could have happened that would have rendered a lot of phones, useless. But that didn't happen. This was found by a security researcher, and it was fixed by Google and by these other companies, or rather, I should say, it's being fixed right now by these other companies. And so no one has been negatively affected by stage fright. It was just a thing that happened a couple of months ago that is now being fixed.
When you talk about it,
weird way to explain that.
When you talk about a security researcher, is that somebody who's paid to comb through these operating systems to find these kind of problems?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. There are people who are paid to do this in two different respects. There are people who work for major companies, like the guy who found this particular exploit. And then there are people who do this kind of in their free time. And a lot of companies offer bounties and rewards for people who submit these exploits to those companies. Google has a huge system where they offer rewards up as high as, you know, $10,000 for major exploits that are found for their things. And then they end up getting fixed in the background before we ever know that it's a problem.
Are there any ways to find out if your phone is vulnerable to the stage fright exploit?
There are apps that you can download that will tell you that you have, you know, parts of this that are potentially affected. But it's really complicated the way that this kind of gets disseminated. It's not something that your phone right now is going to get a text message and then just start blowing up, because there have already been safeguards put in place to stop some of this from happening.
Okay.
But if you have an older phone, it may take longer for that update to reach your device. So if you've had your phone for, let's say, 2 or 3 years, then there's a good chance that if someone does get a hold of this code and decide to do something malicious with it, that your phone may be affected before a fix is issued to it. Is the closest way to say, you know, how it is that you're at risk of being affected. And the easiest way to make sure that you're not affected is to turn off, there's a check button in your text messaging app that will say whether or not you download messages before you open them.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn that off, and then you only open messages from people that you know.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. You wanted to talk about YouTube gaming. What's the difference between YouTube gaming and just YouTube?
Not much. YouTube gaming is a visually restructured version of YouTube that is focused on live game streaming and people who have recorded gameplay and things like that. So instead of going to all of YouTube and searching for, you know, let's play videos of people playing, Call of Duty or Splatoon or something like that, you can actually just go to this new Call of Duty channel or Splatoon channel and watch all of that content kind of aggregated in one place.
Okay, so it's for observers of the game, not players.
Well, it will eventually grow into players. What we're seeing now is a very early version of the application that some people have been invited to see. It's supposed to be out this fall, where users are going to have the ability to broadcast their own games, very much in the same way that Twitch works right now. Where you can go and share your games with other people so that they can watch as you play. Because this is apparently kind of a big deal. There are a lot of people who enjoy watching gameplay in very much the same way that people enjoy watching sports.
Yeah, I know. I've done segments on that before. It's astounding. I mean, there's a place in Columbus that has these big tournaments that people go to watch.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and they have cheerleaders and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's really weird. And, you know, all kinds of endorsements and whatever you call it, sponsorships and blah, blah, blah. It's sports, right? So when you were talking about Switch, right?
Switch, yeah.
Yeah, comparing it to that. With that, when you want to share your gaming, your gameplay, that's with just specific people. With YouTube, you'd just be posting it in a way that anybody could find you?
Well, so Twitch kind of acts like its own social network in that, you know, you have to have a Twitch account in order to communicate and do stuff. And so it's this kind of separate service. But a lot of people already have YouTube accounts, and a lot of people use YouTube for just kind of random watching. So the potential for a larger audience is really what you gain from considering YouTube over Twitch, because there are just so many more people using YouTube.
Right. Okay. And what about cost? Any fees associated with it?
So far, there hasn't been any mention of fees associated. And, you know, Google has always had a pretty inexpensive policy when it comes to storing really just absurdly large amounts of video because it's an ad-driven network, and everyone involved makes money based on the ad. So there's a reasonable chance that we will see that same setup where there will just be ads injected in the Let's Play videos and the live streams that get played, and money will be made that way.
But not until they get us addicted to it.
I'm sure that there are already ads baked into this service, just probably not something that the creators have control over just yet.
Okay. Okay, so when will it be released to consumers? It's still in beta, right? So
it's still in beta now. There's been talk of it happening this fall. I would not be surprised to see something around October, but they haven't given an official date for it yet.
Okay. News. Google has a new name and a new structure. Finally, a name I think I can probably remember, although I had to be reminded of it this morning, even after I just heard the report on NPR. Alphabet, what's going on?
So we all got this this letter last night as everyone was leaving the office here that Google was no longer the umbrella company for all of their products. You know, so when we think about Calico, the medical research group that Google owns, or the robotics company that Google owns, or the guys that are responsible for Nest and Google Glass and all of that stuff. You know, previously they had all kind of been umbrellaed under Google, and that's no longer the case. Effective today, they are now all, including Google, under the umbrella of this company called Alphabet. It is owned and run by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who are the guys who have run Google from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of larger umbrella company will just, you know, do better about, you know, putting money in places where they feel like it needs to go. And sometimes that means putting money in places that aren't immediately profitable. And sometimes it means putting it, you know, taking money from places that are incredibly profitable, like their ads and Android and things like that. And you know, comparing it to their kind of weird X Lab with self-driving cars and robots that walk around and do stuff, and so it's just this larger umbrella to better encapsulate all of the, you know, just the crazy span of things that Google as a company does now.
And you're okay with this? Does it make a big heck of a lot of difference for people in the tech world?
Doesn't seem like it actually affects me all that big. You know, as far as how, you know, the day-to-day things for Google and Android are going to go. It means that Sundar Pichai, who was the gentleman who had basically been running the Android and Chrome teams at Google for the longest time, is now running all of Google while Larry and Sergey take over things at Alphabet. And I think that's pretty cool because Sundar has done a really good job with Google and Android. He's an incredibly intelligent individual. The few times that I've had to talk to him have been really positive. So I think ultimately this is going to be a good thing.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, thank you so much as usual.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. That's it for Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.